The words for meditation this morning come from Jeffrey Eugenides in his novel Middlesex. Emotions, in my experience, aren't covered by single words. I don't believe in sadness, joy, or regret. Maybe the best proof that language is patriarchal is that it oversimplifies feeling. I'd like to have at my disposal complicated hybrid emotions, Germanic train car constructions, like, say, the happiness that attends disaster, or the disappointment of sleeping with one's fantasy. I'd like to show how intimations of mortality brought on by aging family members connects with the hatred of mirrors that begins in middle age. I'd like to have a word for the sadness inspired by failing restaurants, as well as for the excitement of getting a room with a minibar. I've never had the right words to describe my life, and now that I've entered my story, I need them more than ever. Let's have a moment of silence for reflection, meditation, or prayer. Our meditation song today is number 396. I know this rose will open. We will sing it once and we'll sing it sitting down. So for those of you who may be wondering why I feel like I can stand up here and fake knowing what I'm talking about, I got my master's degree in linguistics from the University of Georgia. Now, linguistics is a wide and varied field. There's neurolinguistics, which studies the brain and how it processes language. There are linguists who study language acquisition in infancy and beyond. There are linguists who write search algorithms for Google, and linguists who work on artificial translation. There are linguists who brought us Klingon and Na'vi. I studied historical linguistics, which involved a lot of really cool topics: phonology, morphology, syntax, dialectology, lexicology and semantics, Greek, Sanskrit, Latin, and Proto-Indo-European. And I studied these things because they were super cool. But let me share with you the most important thing I learned, which is that studying subjects that are super cool without a plan for what to do with them afterwards, boys and girls, is how you end up on an exciting career as a legal assistant. But I still love linguistics, and I think about language all the time. It's on my mind a lot, actually, as we have come to a national awareness about the power that words have. And as we all wonder sometimes, whether words still have any objective meaning at all. So what is language? There are a few technical definitions out there that linguists use, but the easiest way to think about it is that it's a tool. It's a way of getting thoughts from inside one skull to inside another skull. And this process is key to human civilization. And in the grand scheme of things, society and language are nearly inseparable, but where they specifically intersect is the study of sociolinguistics. The use and status of a language within a society affects a lot of people a lot of the time. And I'm going to talk about just a few examples. I know as I talk that you will probably think of 100 more that I will not have time to get to today. And believe me, I tried. I had to cut this thing down a lot. So language politics has been a part of English-speaking culture since before English was English. The first people documented in England were Celtic Britons, who spoke common Brittonic languages in points south of present-day Edinburgh, and Pictish languages to the north. Then the Romans winny-witty-weechied, and Latin had its day in the sun as the language of the ruling class. And after the Romans left, the Germanic tribes invaded. These were the Angles, Saxons, Frisians, and Jutes. Now, the native Celts outnumbered the Anglo-Saxons almost 4-1, but somehow it was the Celts that got absorbed into the new Germanic society, both culturally and linguistically. And the reason for that, as we are informed by the Venerable Bede, is that language was a key indicator of ethnicity in early England. In circumstances where freedom at law, acceptance with the kindred, access to patronage, and the use and possession of weapons were all exclusive to those who could claim Germanic descent, then speaking Old English without Latin or Brittonic inflection had considerable value. Now, this phenomenon from all the way back in the Dark Ages is still happening today, and today we call it code switching. It goes on in every language. Anywhere a minority culture is expected to conform to the majority culture. Code switching is much more complex than just manners, knowing when to say ma'am and sir. It happens at the dialectal level. So before we go any further, we have to define the word dialect. It's basically a regional or ethnic variation in a language, and it's more than an accent. It happens at the level of pronunciation, grammar, and vocabulary. And most of the time, speakers of different dialects of a language understand each other. But if you have ever wondered if your aunt from Cincinnati was offering to smack you when she offered you a pop, and then been disappointed to find out she was handing out Cokes after you already said no, or if you have had to decipher a Boston native asking where to pack the cat, you run into a dialectal difficulty. In the United States, our prestige dialect is standard American English. This is Walter Cronkite's English, your seventh grade grammar teacher's English, NPR English, proper English, with what we consider a neutral American accent. And there's a reason both of these folks are white. Standard American English is generally a native dialect, only for white people, usually fairly educated and middle class. Strangely, once you get super rich, you don't have to speak standard American English anymore, if you think about the Kennedys and what they sounded like. But standard English is just one American dialect spoken in the U.S. There are ethnic dialects like African American Vernacular English and Chicano or Barrio English. There are regional dialects like American Southern English and Mid-Atlantic English, and the list goes on and on. Native speakers of minority dialects have for a long time, and still are, forced by the norms of American culture to code switch on a daily basis, especially in school or the professional realm, and being unable to switch into standard American English at will is a barrier to socioeconomic success. It's ingrained in our society that standard American English is the only correct way to speak, and that all these other dialects are just bad English. But these dialects have distinct vocabularies and grammars with rules just as rigid as those of standard American English. People who can code switch with ease are almost bilingual in that they have internalized two sets of vocabulary and syntactical rules and use each when needed. But it doesn't really work in both directions, does it? A person who is a native speaker of standard American English who tries code switching when speaking to a minority audience will find themselves in hot water. Most of that has to do with issues of cultural appropriation, but it's also because most of the time, a native speaker of standard English has never had to internalize that other dialect, and they aren't fluent or even very good at it. At best, it comes off as clumsy mimicry, and at worst, it's insulting. And the name for that, appropriately, is verbal blackface. So the dialect recognized as the prestige dialect of English has shifted over the centuries. After the Norman conquest in 1066, suddenly the language of government and nobility and official communications, and thus the prestige dialect, was Norman French, while the average Ethelred was still speaking an Anglo-Saxon dialect. The mix of these two linguistic worlds gave us the era of Middle English, which was spoken from about 1150 to 1500. In this period, we find English absorbing a raft of French origin vocabulary, and in their modern English equivalents, we see that sort of highbrow, lowbrow duality. By the 14th century, the upper classes and lower classes began to meet in the middle when it came to the language, and the emerging London dialect was becoming the dialect of educated and literary people. This is the dialect Chaucer wrote his Canterbury Tales in. And by about 1550, English had basically finished morphing into the language we recognize, though if you've ever had trouble reading Shakespeare or the King James Bible, you know it wasn't quite there yet. This dialect of English, early modern or Elizabethan English, was the dialect that got taken on a trip around the world as the age of exploration and colonization began. But as the English-speaking world expanded, London's reign as the English prestige dialect actually began to weaken. In every colony and military outpost and trading center, the dialect of the English settlers, or soldiers, mixed with the local substrate languages, got a new accent, new vocabulary, even new grammar. In far-flung places like India, Australia, or the American colonies, the local speech developed in isolation from the prestige London dialect, and the differences became reinforced generation after generation until those differences became standardized into their own recognizable dialects. And as nice as it is now to travel all over the globe and expect to be able to speak English to everyone, the behemoth of global English is exacting a price. Language death is now occurring at a depressing rate. About 7,000 languages are spoken on Earth today, and only about half are expected to last until the end of the century. Globalization, oppression of minority linguistic communities, loss of minority language representation in mass media, and displacement due to war are all to blame. Climate change is expected to become one of the greatest stressors on linguistic communities as entire cultures are uprooted by its effects. Here in the U.S., language is tied inextricably to the ugly side of nationalism. If you've ever seen any of the numerous online videos of people being discriminated against, being yelled at, and becoming the target of suspicion and even violence for speaking a language other than English inside the boundaries of the United States, you have seen this. Speaking a language other than English, especially Spanish these days, with its association with undocumented immigrants, is seen as at least un-American and possibly probable cause for accusations of lawbreaking or even terrorism. The organized face of this attitude is the English-only movement or the official English movement. They're slightly different in scope, but not much. Their goal is to have English be the only officially recognized language of the United States. Now, the U.S. has always been a multilingual society. The 13 colonies included speakers of Dutch, French, German, and the many languages spoken by Native Americans and enslaved Africans. But English was and always has been the dominant language, and the government has never felt the need to take steps to specifically elevate English as the official language. Despite that, English-only impulses are also a part of this country's history. Enslaved people were forbidden from speaking a language other than English. Native American children were sent to boarding schools where they were punished for speaking their native languages. In fact, American linguistics as a field was born out of anthropologists attempting to document Native American languages on the brink of extinction. In a startling bit of irony, the Navajo code talkers that helped save our bacon in World War II had attended a school where students were chained for speaking Navajo. 31 states have made English their official language, 27 of them since the 1980s. Proffering reasons like saving money on printing and translating signs and official documents. But a lot of these states adopted English as their official language during a time when immigrant populations were growing and were perceived as a problem. You see that Louisiana has a star in it. That's because English is not their only official language. Luckily, a lot of these English-only laws are toothless and don't have much real impact on the lives of immigrants, but the fact that they are passed when immigration is in the news is telling. The problem hit home right here in Florida during the 2018 election, after thousands of Puerto Ricans came to Florida after the hurricane and found themselves denied the ability to vote in Spanish. A coalition of advocacy groups had to sue Secretary of State Kenneth Detzner and 32 county election supervisors to force them to follow federal law that protects the right of Puerto Ricans who are American citizens and are in this day and age educated in Spanish to vote in their own language. Luckily, this past May, the federal judge ruled for the plaintiffs and gave the defendants a tidy scolding along with it, and the oversight will be corrected for future elections. As of the last census in 2010, the United States was the fifth largest Spanish-speaking country in the world, with 36.7 million people speaking Spanish in the home. More recent estimates have us as the second largest, behind only Mexico. And as daunting as that sounds for the future of English in this country, the fact is that English speakers are by far the majority here. Immigrants are under immense pressure from many angles, including their own desire to learn English, and so most all of them eventually do. English is in no danger of this in this country. But of course, we couldn't talk about language and politics and culture without tackling political correctness, which is a phrase that can provoke a landslide of emotional responses. The first time I heard this phrase, decades ago, it was used unironically, but I recall that lasting only a very short time. Now you usually hear it used sarcastically and dismissively. Political correctness has been given the connotation of form over substance, but it came from a sincere place, a desire to acknowledge people's desire to live their true identities, to respect and dignify their journeys and their basic humanity. Sometimes it's a simple change, saying enslaved people or disabled people rather than slaves or the disabled, because that acknowledges that first they are people before describing their circumstances. One of the reasons political correctness is such a flashpoint has to do with the relationship between language and culture, and many gallons of philosophical ink have been spilled over whether language change drives cultural change or whether language change reflects cultural change. The chicken or the egg. In my observation, when it comes to deliberate attempts to change culture by changing language, there are two ends to the spectrum. On one end, you have the rather practical approach of repurposing existing words. The LGBTQ community worked linguistic miracles by reclaiming the words gay and queer. And while those words can still be flung out with the intent to hurt, those terms are no longer derogatory or insulting in and of themselves. The LGBTQ community owns those words. And the reclaiming of those words went hand in hand with an assertion of identity and demand for equal rights. And while the battle is far from over, there is a much wider acceptance and support for equality on a national scale. And this was a case of a perfect rhythm between language change and cultural change, with both being nudged along in a deliberate way, but neither language nor culture getting out too far ahead of one another. Now, on the opposite end of that spectrum is the approach of coining a new word to fill a cultural need. An example was an attempt that began 20 or so years ago to find a new word to describe, well, there still isn't one word to describe them. More and more, they're called nuns. Atheists, agnostics, skeptics, freethinkers, humanists, non-theists, secularists, anyone who checks the nun box on a list of religious affiliations. But the word that was put out back then was bright. It was not a bad idea. It was supposed to erase the negative connotations of the words containing the privative ah, and to be positive and optimistic, and the fact that bright is a synonym for intelligence didn't hurt at all. But in my experience in the community, it never really caught on. And the idea behind it was generally applauded, and there were a few prominent people who have used it, but bright just never really happened. And there are, I think, at least two reasons behind this. First, almost everyone in this community has been on a long and often difficult journey, and their choice of label is very thoughtful and deliberate. That I choose to call myself atheist says something about me that is a little different than someone who chooses to identify primarily as a freethinker. So as much as we struggle to identify the community by one name, members of the community itself resisted that, holding on to their chosen labels because they remain deeply meaningful. Second, bright just had a subtle hint of trying too hard. A movement to adopt a new term can sometimes push a change in language too far ahead of what's happening organically in the culture, and that's what leaves behind that slight artificial taste that nobody likes. Another place where language and culture are colliding in American English is pronouns. The pronoun someone wishes to be referred to by is deeply personal and essential to their identity. It is not only insulting to refuse a transgender person's request to be referred to by their chosen pronoun, it affects their mental health. But linguistically, non-binary people have it the worst. If you're still in touch with Honor Bell, you've witnessed this struggle. Most of us knew Honor as a young man, but since moving out west, Honor has blossomed into the fullness of their non-binary identity, and they prefer the pronoun they or them. Now, English has used they as a neuter pronoun since at least the time of Shakespeare, and we use it all the time, but only in very specific circumstances. Looks like somebody ran into the stop sign last night. Whoever they are, they're driving around with a big dent in their car. So when you're talking about someone sort of without a face, someone you don't know and can't really envision in your mind, it's natural to use they. But when you know the person, it doesn't really roll off the tongue as naturally. This is the conundrum Honor faces. They exist in a space that is both between genders and also encompasses both genders, and they are desperate for a pronoun that describes that. They find English wanting in this regard. The existing language they have to choose from is too limited for where they are. And how many of you have lost track of the fact that I'm still talking about a single individual and not non-binary people in general? A language can bear a lot of imperfections, but confusion of meaning is not one of them. I suspect that one of two things will either happen here. Either they will be rejected as the neuter pronoun preferred by non-binary people, and another word entirely will be adopted, or we'll hang on to they as the non-binary pronoun, and English will somehow find another way to deal with the ambiguity. Now, that sounds kind of vague, but to explain how that might happen, I get to show you something cool, a linguistic map. After English lost its second person plural, we were stuck with you for singular, but also you for the plural. Well, that causes confusion, and here you see how the different American English regional dialects have dealt with the ambiguity. And if you can't see that tiny print, the choices are you guys, you, y'all, and you all. And I imagine you can probably figure out which one goes where. You can do maps like this based on all kinds of things. There's a pop Coke soda map. There's a syrup map. There's, you know, all kinds of neat stuff you can do with these. So the language will find a way. It just might take a while to shake out. Now, recently, our own denomination had a bit of a kerfuffle with using language that risked being interpreted as ableist. This means language that could be outright discriminatory against disabled people, or language that just reflects the privilege that non-disabled people have in our world. I have to confess, I am not proud of my first reaction to this. And that reaction was something like, oh, come on. They're right. PC culture is running amok. We've been using stand in this sense for centuries, and everyone knows what we mean. It's not discriminatory. It's just accidentally awkward. But when people who I know are smarter than me think one way about an issue and I think another, that means it's time to re-examine my thought. And in doing so, I remembered Papa. Papa was my grandfather. He was born in 1904 in a West Virginia lumber town that doesn't exist anymore. And he was a fundamentally decent guy. He was salt of the earth, God-fearing, hard-working, teetotaling, give you the shirt off his back no matter what color you are kind of guy. But I have a very clear memory of being about 11 or 12 years old, and this would have been in the early 80s, and hearing him toss out the N-word in casual conversation. Now, of course, I wanted to know why I got threatened with having my mouth washed out with soap if I used this word. Papa got a pass. So my mother explained to me that he was born in a different time and lived in a different world, and he was just old and set in his ways. The word didn't mean anything to him. And because I was a good white, suburban, middle-class, sheltered child, my response to that was, oh, okay. And it took me growing up a little more and becoming a little more aware of the world to realize that my dear, sweet papa was a little bit racist. Because by the 1980s, he should have been kind of clued into the fact that that word was not only not acceptable in polite company, but it was hateful and hurtful and demeaning. But he just hadn't put forth the effort to quit using it. And the reason he didn't do that is because he had never been on the receiving end of that hate and hurt and violence and discrimination. And that's where I am now. Firmly standing in the place of someone who has not had to navigate the world with all its difficulties and obstacles and insults to people with disabilities. So who the hell am I to say that using standing in its metaphorical sense isn't hurtful? And maybe someday we won't have to worry about words like that. Maybe someday we'll get busy making this world more welcoming and accessible to people with disabilities. Maybe the healthcare resources they need just to function on a daily basis will be there. Maybe they won't have to fight every day for their rights and their dignity, and language like standing on the side of love won't be triggering. Or maybe us acknowledging the latent discrimination buried under words like that is the first step in creating that world. Maybe in this case, linguistic awareness will trigger the cultural change. The chicken or the egg? I'm willing to give it a try and find out. Language is not an unstoppable force, nor is it inevitable. It is a tool, and it does not change without the will of the humans who use it. We live in a world that feels just angry and charged with words that are everything from careless to insulting to deliberately divisive and deceitful. So while it may seem a small thing to choose words carefully, words that do no harm, language chosen in love and compassion and truth, language that honors our first UU principle of respecting the inherent worth and dignity of every person, is an act of resistance. There is power in every word. Make it count. The closing words are an adaptation of the Pilgrim's Covenant by the Reverend Alison Wohler. We pledge to walk together in the ways of truth and affection as best we understand them now, or may learn them in the days to come, that we and our children might be fulfilled, and that we might speak to the world in words and actions of peace and goodwill. Go in peace.